Hello, my name's Kate Rolls and I'm interviewing you for the Wellcome Trust as you're taking part in Anthony Gormley's new artwork, One and Other. The date today is the 8th of August 2009 and the time is 10:17 a.m. If I can please ask you to state your full name, your date of birth and where you come from.
My name is Alison Penton Harper. I was born on the 1st of March 1964 and I live in Northamptonshire.
Lovely. And how are you today, Alison?
I'm very well indeed, thank you.
Yeah. Good. And what was it that motivated you to apply to be part of One Another?
As soon as I heard about the project and saw about it, I think I read it first about it first in the newspapers, and then I think I had seen some material about it. It really struck me as a fantastic installation for the fourth plinth, and it got me really excited, and I just thought I really want to be a part of that.
Brilliant. And when you found out that you were going to be, that you had a place, how did you decide how to use your hour on the plinth?
Well, with the nature of the British summer, one never knows if you're going to be stuck in a gale force wind or some lashing rain. But I quite determined that I wanted to work on a piece of art myself while I was up there. And being a writer, I felt that the piece of art would be some kind of written expression rather than a painting, because the painting would take me too long and I'm not very good. So I've decided to work on a kind of part observational, part confessional canvas just for the hour. And whatever I end with at the end of the hour, that's what it's going to be.
And you're going to write on canvas?
Yes. I've had a few practice runs to check if it works okay, and pens work surprisingly well on canvas, and so I've got a handful of pens, a nice blank canvas to start on, and we'll see what takes shape.
Great. Would you like to say a little bit about your own writing, your work?
Well, I've written six novels, predominantly comedy. I wrote the Housewife books, starting with Housewife up in 2005. The fifth book in that series is going to be published in February 2010. And so that's been quite a long series, but I also work on historical fiction, although the piece that I've been working on has taken 3 years out of my life, and I'm not quite sure whether or not it's finished. So as a writer, I live mainly in my head, and to look up now and again and observe what's going on, I can't think of a better place to do that than the plinth.
And what does it mean to you personally to stand on the fourth plinth?
I actually feel quite moved about it. I'm one of those people, I suppose I could be accused of being overly emotional, but I hope not particularly sentimental. But I find the whole project very moving. That cross-section snapshot of the kind of people that are living in the country. And having seen some of the plinths that have been up there to date, it restores one's faith in humanity. You know, people are very interesting, and it really does take all sorts to make a world. I feel very lucky to have got that place, and I'm going to enjoy every moment of it.
And just to go back a little bit to your writing, how does it feel to have your work published?
It's wonderful. It's also a bit scary, because every time a book comes out and I pick it up in a bookshop, it's probably many months since I've written that book, and invariably I will open it and look at it and think, oh, you know, perhaps I could have done that a bit differently. So I'm always quite critical of the work, but I love writing. I'm actually a very lucky person that my life has worked out, that I'm able to do something I absolutely love. And I think that the arts are terribly important in all their forms, because without art, without literature, without all these kind of things that make humans what they are, I think the world would be a very empty and sad place.
And what inspires you to write the work that you write, the comedies and the historical?
I love writing comedy, but at the same time I also write tragedy. I think it has to, the two to go hand in hand. To be able to understand one, you have to understand the other. Writing helps me make sense of the world. It's very cathartic. It helps me to pick things apart and to see how they're made up. And it's also a superb opportunity to refine and refine. Sometimes one finds oneself in a situation. The French have a great expression called l'esprit de l'escalier or something like that, and it means literally in the spirit of the staircase. And you know, sometimes you may have found yourself in a situation where you have words with somebody and then you leave, and just as you're leaving you think of the perfect thing that you could have said in the circumstance. That's what the French call esprit de l'escalier. And writing gives you the ability to do that every day, because you can come back and refine and refine, and you know exactly what the right thing would have been to say. It's a very, yeah, it's a very lovely way for me to live my life. I love writing.
Did you study writing?
I didn't. I worked in advertising for many years, and I was a copywriter for a long time. And although I haven't studied writing, I've always been an avid reader. I was since I was quite a young child, and I've always written. But I never intended to do anything about it and to do anything with it. But then some years ago, I had my first novel published in quite unusual circumstances. And it's the old don't look a gift horse in the mouth. If now is the time, then now is the time. And sometimes you have to be brave. You have to be brave enough to set fire to a bridge and be prepared to just keep walking and see what's on the other side.
Why were the circumstances unusual?
I had entered a competition with the Richard and Judy show on Channel 4. And at the time I had flu, because I never watched daytime TV. I was working full time. At the time I had flu, and they were running a competition, something to do with, so would you like to be published? Inviting to send in one chapter of an adult fiction novel. And because I had flu and I absolutely couldn't move, I sat down and wrote one chapter of a novel just to give me something to do. And then it was a long time later that I found it and posted it in. And then 5 months after that, I had a call from Channel 4. And the reason it had taken so long is that they had 46,000 entries. And I thought they were ringing 46,000 people to say, sorry, thanks but no thanks. And the next thing I knew, it was 4 weeks later and I had a publishing deal. So it was very unexpected. And I was heavily ensconced in my previous career. So I did have to juggle things around for a while before I made the decision to burn the bridge and just to concentrate on the writing.
How long have you been writing now?
Well, as I say, I've always written, but I have been writing seriously as a career now for 4 or 5 years. And I still feel like I'm learning.
Yeah. Moving forward, what plans do you have for further work?
I have lots of plans afoot. One of the problems with writing is that it takes so long. And so to sit down and expect a novel to take form properly, I should probably be allowing 6 months. But then time goes out of the window, and so all these things that I want to do, I know they're going to take me a long time. So I'll be a granny by the time I look up and take a breath of air.
Would you like to say any of those things that you want to do?
I'd like to write. I'm fascinated by film, and I would really like to write a screenplay that I'm happy with. I have written a couple of screenplays, but they are really rubbish. And so I'm still working on refining that particular medium. But writing applies to everything. You know, I'd like to write not just the novels, but I love writing novels. I'd like to write for the stage, I'd like to write for the screen, I'd like to write for television. I love radio. I've just finished working on a radio play, which I haven't actually done anything with yet, because I like to wait and look at something and feel that I'm happy with it myself, but that's often never the case. So yes, I have lots of things to write, and God willing, I'll live long enough to do it.
Do you keep a diary as well?
I keep a journal. It's not necessarily a reflection of what's happened in the day. because I'm notoriously disorganised. But yeah, I keep a journal. I've always kept a journal. Keeping a journal, as I say, it helps me to make sense of things. And it's also, it's like a form of therapy, a really nice, quiet form of therapy.
And you, as a person now, we've spoken a lot about your work. Would you like to say a little bit about yourself? Perhaps we start with your background, with where you come from.
Right. My mother is Indian. She's from the remote state of Assam, where they grow all the tea. My father was a strapping great Englishman. I was born... East London, and stayed there for quite some time, and then my parents moved out to the country. I like the city. I'm really a city person, even though I don't live in the city anymore. I have two fantastic teenage daughters, one of who's in college, the other one's about to start university. My husband is lovely. He's an artist and designer. We're a very creative household. I'm also from a family of musicians. My father was a pianist. I play, one of my daughters plays. I also paint. And it's been nice to have been brought up in a sort of bohemian manner, which is why I find this whole project so exciting as well. Anything that's a big statement piece of art, it excites me.
And can I ask, I'm a bit uncertain about asking this, but yeah. How was it growing up in a dual race?
In a mixed race environment?
Yeah.
Well, that's quite interesting because I grew up in the 60s. I was born in 1964. And it was in the 60s that the trouble really, really started with immigration and with racism. And it affected the culture, it affected the way that people interacted with each other. And although I know that there has been much broadcast and said about programmes like, for example, Till Death Us Do Part, and about the Afghani character being, you know, bigoted, and that the whole thing was meant to be a comedy, but in my opinion, I actually think that had a terrible effect. A terrible effect, you know, and from my point of view, I was very commonly called things like packy and wog and all those kind of words that now make your skin shrivel. My mother was subjected to terrible abuse. The man next door threatened her with a lump hammer one day. I remember it all very well. I think things are changing. I think it will take a very long time for those things to change. And I think that especially when you're a small child, you're pretty much colourblind. You have no concept of who is what colour, per se. Mm-hmm. Especially if you're used to living in an environment where people are all different colours. The family two doors up from us, they had come over from Jamaica. They had Jamaican roots. But of course, the English guy stuck between the two houses. It was as though the worst possible affliction had been visited upon him, because he had a black family living at one side and an Asian mixed family living on the other side. And the guy absolutely couldn't handle it. It was very, very common. And so I grew up with, I suppose I could describe it as a really multifaceted view of the issues surrounding racism. And I don't care what the official line was. It's the people living next to each other on the streets. That's the grassroots of where these things happen. And the politicians can say what they like, but these things are issues that have to be dealt with in a really broad brush way. And so airing programs where it was okay to call somebody Sambo because they were black, the fact is then the next day in the playground, every child thinks it's all right to call a person with a black face Sambo. So very complicated. It was a very, very interesting time. I can only imagine how my mother suffered. I can only imagine, because she never spoke of it.
And
yeah,
no, it's important to talk about these things. Do you think that's affected your writing?
Oh, definitely. In fact, my first novel, there was a chapter in there that was set in India. I love India, by the way. I didn't actually visit India till my later years, and I go every year now. And the book that I have just recently finished, which is called The Secret Children, it's quite an epic story that is set in India, and it's very much hinged in what happened with those men of the British Raj who had taken up with Indian concubines, because a lot of these people had children and a lot of these children were denied and hidden, and it's a really multi-layered story, which is about identity, I suppose racism to a degree, but not overtly. It's more a case of exploring the layers of prejudice and exploring the layers of relationships between men and women, because in some countries, of course, women are not equal to men. And then, of course, one has things like caste system, which was very much apparent then and still is to a degree. So yes, it has affected, I think it affects everything that I am. It's very much a part of me, you know, which is why I do tend to say to people, I will volunteer very early that I'm half Indian. I mean, my father was very fair, so I don't necessarily look it. And also in my own children, in my two daughters, my first daughter is very dark and the other one looks like a milk bottle. And so it just shows how genes, as they start filtering down, there will come a day when we are just homogenized. How long that will be, I don't know, but there will come a day when nobody is what they think they are.
Would you like to say a little bit about your daughters and how it is to have a family now?
Family to me is very important, very important. It pains me awfully, the general degeneration of the family unit, because I think that that's what knits people together, it's what knits communities together, and when you start neglecting the family unit, then there is no nurturing environment. And when there's no nurturing environment, you start raising a race that's different from the race that we have been used to. I have great faith in young people. I know a lot of young people. My daughters, as we speak, are 17 and 18 years old, and they just fascinate me. Everything about life for them now is so different than it was for me. I mean, the thought of a computer, it was the kind of thing you saw in a James Bond film, and it took up a massive, massive room, and it had lots of blinking lights on it and bits of tape spewing out of slots. I mean, the way that the world has accelerated over the years. But family is everything to me. Family always comes first. I go a lot of places with my sister. I have a really nice, loving family unit. My daughters, my husband, my mother, who is aging now. I have a brother in Australia who I miss very much. But yeah, family's everything. I think family's the most important. If everything were to be taken away from me today, that's the one thing that I would fight for and hang on to. Mm-hmm. You could take everything else away, and I wouldn't care that much.
And who is your partner? Who are you married to?
My husband's name is Jonathan, Jonathan Penton, and he is a superbly talented designer, an artist absolutely through and through, and I think that's part of the love that glues us together, because we're two very creative people, and I think that a creative person can only live with another creative person. Otherwise, you would just walk around thinking that your partner's mad, and that's from the point of view of somebody who finds those things weird. My husband has often said to me that he thinks I'm the most tormented person he knows, and he finds scraps of paper all around the house. I have a very bad habit of, I think of an idea, or I think of a line, or I think of a word that's better than the word that I used 3 days ago in a piece. And so I'll write it down, and he'll find these little pieces of paper all around the house. And he says sometimes he'll pick up a piece of paper, and whatever's written on it is just so random. He thinks to himself, I don't even want to know. I don't dare ask. But he's just as bad, because I find things, little sketches and scribbles, and I look at it and think, well, what on earth is that? And it'll transpire that it's a little particular piece of something that he's designing just to try and resolve. So we're one as bad as the other. But yeah, we're very lucky. I think to find somebody who you truly love through and through and who truly loves you, I think it's luck. I think the chances of finding that person are remote. Even if you're as sure as you can be at the time, you know, even all these years later, we're still very much in love. And that has got to be luck.
And your mother, you mentioned,
yes,
is aging. Would you
she
like to say
is my mother's name is Mary, and she's very small, and she's very sweet, and she's very wise. She's one of those people who keeps herself to herself. She's very quiet, but she knows the kind of things that we can't even possibly imagine. She has travelled widely. She has lived through that dreadful period of being an immigrant, and she was a highly educated and professionally qualified woman when she came to the UK, and I think she was 30 when she came to the UK, but was just treated very badly, and there was very little respect. People couldn't see past the colour of the skin, and I think that living through that and still retaining that grace and serenity, it takes a certain person to do that, and never underestimate what lies beneath. With Mary, she's very wise and very wonderful, and she would be here. She really wanted to come because she's a great Anthony Gormley fan, but she felt it would just be a little bit beyond her frailties. And so there is one phone call I'm going to be making from the plinth, and I'm going to be calling my mother.
And yeah. Your father, would you like to say a little bit about
that? My father was an amazing man. He was a brilliant musician. And he passed away 2 years ago, which was very, very tough for all of us. But mercifully, it wasn't too drawn out. He ailed and got sick, and he died within 2 months. So whilst it was a terrible time, and it was, somebody might as well have stuck their hand through my chest, ripped my, took my heart out and stamped on it, because we were like peas in a pod, the pair of us, and very much in each other's pockets. I miss him, but I'm glad that it was over for him very quickly, and I'm just blown away that I had a father like that. And I feel him with me every day, because we were very similar. And so I do feel that he's a very big part of me. But that's the legacy of what your parents leave for you. And it can be good or bad. And I'm just lucky, because the legacy that I've been left is very good.
And what did he do for his profession?
He was a pianist. He was, I say pianist. He was a jazz musician, and he was a brilliant transcriber. What he could do, he could listen to a piece of music, no matter how complicated, and he could write it down, dot perfect, as sheet music. And as far as I'm aware, there is nobody else who could do it the way that he could. And he specialised in transposing the music of the old masters, people like Fats Waller, Art Tatum, and even people like Errol Garner, where the thought of actually putting what he's doing down on sheet music, it blows your brain up. But he could do it, and he could do it very, very well. He also wrote outstanding big band arrangements. He could listen to a piece by the Duke Ellington Orchestra that doesn't exist anywhere written down, and he could write down every piece for every instrument, and it would be just perfect. He was very, very well known for this. But musicians, you know, musicians are a certain type of people. And he had once said to me, and I think, and this is a phrase that I think was Art Blakey or something, he said, if I knew I was going to live this long, I'd have taken better care of myself. And I think it was that kind of case, because he lived mainly on whiskey.
And now, going back to you and your time on the plinth today.
Yes.
How do you feel about standing on the fourth plinth in Trafalgar Square personally?
I'm a little bit nervous. I'm a very reclusive person by nature. It's rare that I can be coaxed out of my house. I don't see people. I tend to stick to my family and my very good friends, who I'm very lucky to have a nice network of friends. But aside from that, I keep myself to myself. And so the thought of standing on the plinth, and I think it was possibly one of the things that made me apply for it, because it struck me as, oh my goodness, I couldn't do that. It's like, yeah, go on, yes you can. So I'm a little bit nervous about it. I'm a little bit nervous about feeling exposed. And the strange thing is, I mean exposed emotionally. Because it might just be a really emotional experience up there, and I'm sure once I get going, I just start crying. And there's nothing I can do about it. You know, those sort of feelings. I tend to invite them in, but I think a lot of writers do that. They will invite things that will perhaps make them uncomfortable or unsettle them or take them out of their comfort zone. I hate that phrase. I'm really looking forward to my time up there. I am a little bit nervous, but it's nothing that a nice big glass of wine afterwards won't bother.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.